welcome to the Atlanta Opera Das Rheingold Limited Series, where we explore topics around Richard Wagner's Das Rheingold and the Ring Cycle. I'm your host, Stefano Sarzani. I'm the assistant conductor for this production, and on today's episode, I will be speaking with Maestro Arthur Fagan about the music of the Ring and his approach to conducting Das Rheingold for the Atlanta Opera. Welcome, Maestro. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good, good. So, we are talking about Wagner and Das Rheingold, and I know that there's a juicy, interesting story about your first approach with Wagner when you were a very young conductor. Can you tell us something about your experience with Wagner music at the very beginning?
Well, I was hired as an assistant conductor at the Frankfurt Opera when I was 22, and the music director, Christoph von Dohnányi, had me be his assistant for Parsifal. And at one of the stage orchestra rehearsals, he let me conduct for a half an hour. And that was my first time in an opera pit, not what you would normally expect, a Mozart or a Verdi opera, but Parsifal.
A true baptism of fire, as yes. One could say. And actually, it relates to Wagner, right?
Right. That was the beginning of my opera conducting career.
That's fantastic. So, like, it starts with Wagner, and it starts with, like, the last of Wagner's opera, Parsifal. So, like, you have really very long connection with this music.
Yes. And during the course of my career, I've conducted every major Wagner opera except for Tristan. And I didn't do Rienzi. I don't know if that's considered a major opera or not. Yeah,
that's fantastic. So, speaking of which, like, when we do Wagner, in a way, the question is, why Wagner? Meaning, like, in Wagner we see a lot of mythological stories. We see gods, dwarves, water maidens, characters that at first sight may seem far from us, but how do they relate to us? Actually, how close they are to us?
Well, all these characters have human qualities. I mean, if you start with the beginning of Rheingold and the Rhine maidens who are trying to entice Alberich, but ultimately they reject his advances and they make fun of him. Mm-hmm. Now, if they had conceded to his advances, there would be no Ring.
But so, like, we've seen characters like Alberich, like, very common human qualities, like greed,
Absolutely. I mean, you find greed in Alberich, you find it also in Wotan. I mean, this lust for money, material things, and power, above all, are in so many of the Wagner characters.
So, like, in it's really much closer to us than actually when we see, like, this mythological figure.
And you see the god Wotan having marital difficulties with his wife Fricka,
bickering all the time.
Yes, it seems very, very human.
There's something very interesting about the system that Wagner uses in order to do make this gigantic work stay and be structured. And it's something that we hear a lot, like, talked about, like, which is the leitmotifs, but we don't, could you, like, actually enlighten us and explain it a little bit to us how he works with this leitmotifs and how do they help us, actually, kind of a map for us?
A leitmotif is a very short musical phrase which can be expressive of a human emotion, a place, a particular character, and he interweaves this throughout the entire Ring. And I think that in Rheingold itself there are over 50 leitmotifs, and I think in the entire Ring it might be as many as 90. And there is an incredibly close relationship between the text and the music. Probably a closer connection beginning in Rheingold than in any other opera until this time. And these leitmotifs come in different guises throughout the Ring depending upon any particular situation, but they're always recognizable. And it's an incredible network which ties the text together with the music in a way that hasn't happened to this degree from any other composer.
And so could we, actually simplifying very much, but could we kind of say that this kind of helps us have a map of what is happening all the time? When there's a certain situation or a certain character, there's a certain music that we recognize and help us guide, understand the entire process of the opera.
Absolutely, yeah.
So like our listeners will never be lost with all this.
Yes, which brings me to the point that, you know, there are many levels in which one can enjoy a Wagner opera.
Mm-hmm.
But to really get inside it as a listener,
mm-hmm,
and somebody watching a Wagner Ring opera,
mm-hmm,
it's very helpful if one does a little preparation in advance of going to a performance and learn a little bit about the leitmotifs. You can start with Rheingold. You don't have to do the entire Ring.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you really a much deeper experience as a listener if one does a little of that preparatory work.
I see. Which, speaking of which, actually connects to the next question I had for you, because there's at the very beginning of Rheingold, there's a very special situation. And in a way, it kind of brings to life the very first of the leitmotifs, like in a way, the nature's leitmotif. And the beginning of Rheingold is something, in a way, unprecedented and absolutely special and unique that, like, prompts the listener into a completely different world. Can you tell us something about this?
Well, this is a very unusual passage in music altogether, because you've got about 4 minutes of music that's all in one key. And it starts on a tonic of E flat, and then it brings in the second overtone, or the third overtone, we can talk the octave, mm-hmm, and the fifth. Now, it is said metaphysically that the music of the spheres is based on the harmonic series.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could say, on one level, the opening of Rheingold, which is normally called the nature motive,
mm-hmm,
can be something akin to portraying sort of the creation of the world, mm-hmm, or the universe. And then after a few minutes of just hearing the E flat and the B flat, which are the first few notes of overtones of the harmonic series, he brings in the third, and into a gentle motion that starts with the celli, which sort of represent the flowing currents of the Rhine.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of builds upon that. They go from eighth notes then into 16th notes. And this all happens within a 4 minute space or so,
mm-hmm,
until the entrance of the Rhine Maidens.
Well, that's fantastic. It's the idea of kind of creating a soundscape, right?
Right.
Like a completely, you know, as you said, the kind of the creation of the world in a way, like from the absolute nothingness to layers and layers that build up and notes and becomes thicker and denser and more. So like it's something that probably no other composer had ever tried to go that far, that radically in a way, kind of. And this is very exciting to see that this is not only the beginning of one opera, but it's the beginning of a long cycle of 4 operas all together. And there's no better place to start them from zero, in a way.
And that is like starting like at the very beginning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So when you see all the leitmotifs, when you see all the connection with the text, can you tell us in a way how you shape your interpretation of, like, does it start from the structure of the music or the structure of the text, or like the two things go together, or like philosophical ideas, or like how do you shape your interpretation of Wagner's music?
Okay, it's a complicated question, but...
You're welcome.
What? But Wagner first wrote the libretti,
mm-hmm,
for his operas.
Mm-hmm.
It all starts with the text. And then the music is written to connect with the text. I shape it basically, first of all, I take into account all the interpersonal relationships that are happening with the characters. Mm-hmm. And I also take into account a phrase that I think Wagner used called melos, mm-hmm. that his music has an ebb and flow. Mm-hmm. And he called it Gesamtkunstwerk, mm-hmm. which kind
of... The work of total art.
You have total art of integrating poetry mm-hmm. together with music and so forth. And there has to be this constant flux, constant minor tempo changes that are not explicitly written faster or slower according to any particular situation. Mm-hmm. You know, when a character gets excited, it implies maybe an accelerando mm-hmm. And reverse, if there's a calming moment, that can be tempo can get slower, and you know it's an awareness how also he uses this incredible orchestra. We have you know the Ring is actually scored for quadruple winds.
Wow!
8 horns.
Wow!
And also the anvils, which are the leitmotif.
Oh yes, we'll talk about that yeah. if you want. Now, tell us more about the orchestration, because this is one of the exciting things about Wagner's music. In a way, like at the time, nobody was taking care of this kind of side of the opera just as much as he was.
Right. And with this enormous orchestra, which also employs four what they call now the Wagner tubas, mm-hmm. which are played by horn players, you've got this very rich, mellifluous sound, mm-hmm. which he used those instruments primarily to indicate the splendor of Valhalla. Mm-hmm. And I think Wagner was the greatest orchestrator up until his time. I mean, Richard Strauss was also a great orchestrator, but Wagner came first. And the way he utilizes all these instruments in all kind of different combinations gives a palette of orchestral expression that I don't think it has been superseded since the time of Wagner.
Absolutely.
It's
incredible.
It's so, the height of what one could do with a symphony orchestra.
Yeah. In a way, this idea of also, it's interesting because this idea of starting from zero that we said about the beginning, like it's again, the idea of starting with a sound, like with some kind of soundscape. So like it's the idea of how to articulate one sound, even before all the musical parameters, like melody, harmony. It's one chord, one harmony.
That's right.
It's sound, pure sound.
Pure sound, but colored. Still, but there's color, but there's still then a lot happening in the orchestration during this opening section until we get to the Rhine Maidens.
Exactly. Is there, so you talked about the anvils, because we have a very cool thing happening in between scene 2 and scene 3 and scene 3 and scene 4, right?
Yes.
What is this thing?
Well, this is about Alberich has stolen the ring, mm-hmm. and Alberich is a Nibelung, mm-hmm. and the Nibelung live underground, mining and pounding the ore to get the gold out, yeah.
So, okay, so we have these instruments that are not really traditional orchestra instruments.
They're not, although Verdi used them in Trovatore,
uh-huh,
but okay. not to the same extent.
Exactly. And they produce this kind of
very metallic sound, this pounding metallic sound.
And very repetitive rhythm that it's unmistakable.
Yes,
and
which is representative of the Nibelungen constantly at work, toiling to get the gold out of the ore.
Almost kind of an infernal vision of this
yes.
constant toiling and beating and digging.
Right.
And Maestro, I mean, we talked a lot about Wagner. You said you did Wagner when you were young. You did conduct a lot of Wagner in Germany. But Wagner in the United States is not as performed as in the German world. And actually, there's in a way only few companies that in the United States do Wagner still, like usually the big ones. And like, what does it mean for a company to be able to do a Wagner opera? And like, what does it mean in a way for the Atlanta Opera do Wagner?
Yes. I mean, the dimensions of doing The Ring are far greater than the dimensions of doing a piece like The Flying Dutchman, which has a much more smaller orchestra, a smaller cast, and is much more related to romantic opera, especially German. You know, you could say that early Wagner has a strong relationship to Beethoven, and even Weber. To Carl Maria von Weber as well. In terms of doing a piece like, or the tetralogy of The Ring, as I mentioned before, you need huge orchestral forces. You need a very big cast because you need special types of singers who have
large voices,
huge voices. And it's a sign, I think, for Atlanta that we are really we've been moving into the major leagues as an opera company.
That's really great. And this for you, I mean, it's to be able to do Wagner in Atlanta. After having done so much also in Europe, like it must be like a great accomplishment.
I think it is a great accomplishment for the Atlanta Opera, and it shows how much, you know, how far forward Tomer has moved this company. And for me, I mean, we've had like two dress rehearsals for The Ring. The first, which was The Flying Dutchman, which is still a much smaller scale endeavor. But then three years ago, we did Salome. And Salome is already moving up towards doing The Ring cycle. But still, The Ring is still one step above Salome.
So like in the entire 2.5 hours of Rheingold, is there a moment like a favorite of yours that like every time you get there, like it's really super exciting?
And what I'm going to say applies not only to Rheingold, but applies very much to Walküre, Siegfried, and Götterdämmerung. The ends of all these operas, especially Wotans Aria at the end, Abendlicht, and the immolation scene from Götterdämmerung, or Wotan's farewell for Walküre. Those scenes, for me, are probably have the most inspiring music that I have ever experienced in my entire life. And, you know, not so much in Rheingold, but in those operas, you know, if you're conducting for 5 hours, you can get a little tired in the middle of the second act or the middle of the third act. But when you get to the final scene, the music is so uplifting and so soaring, and it inspires everybody in the orchestra as well as in the audience.
That's fantastic. I remember having a conversation with you about how, in a way, also the perception of time changes, meaning that, like, sometimes we refer in symphonic music a work that lasts about an hour and a half to be a long work. But then you get to Wagner, and everything becomes relative. And, like, a work that, like, a symphony that lasts about an hour, it's not that long anymore compared to
I mean, when I, you know, there was a time in my life when I thought it was a huge challenge to be able to create a unity out of a Bruckner symphony. But after
usually about an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and 15 minutes.
Maximum. But after doing the Ring cycle, the Bruckner symphony seems to be very navigable.
Speaking of which, actually, on the more personal side, is that when you face such an endeavor, like you have to do 2.5 hours of music in one stint, are there rituals? Are there particular things that you do to prepare or to boost up your energy or I don't know?
Yes, and I have to say,
are they secret?
Rheingold is unique because it's the longest stretch of music in the entire history of music without any break whatsoever, and there's no place where you could really put a satisfactory intermission. So that's a huge challenge. So before I do a piece like Rheingold or The Ring, I try to keep in shape. I'm in a place with a swimming pool. I'm going to go swimming as weather permitting as much as I can to keep the, you know. And, you know, I may take some, I'll take a lot of vitamins, have a good meal before, try to sleep well. It demands a certain degree of fitness.
It's a physical feat. It's an athletic feat.
Yes.
Well, then, thank you very much, Maestro, for this very enlightening conversation and for telling us everything, starting from the personal level to the high-minded musical level and philosophical. And this was really a great pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much again.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Atlanta Opera Das Rheingold Limited Series. Please follow us at the Atlanta Opera to stay up to date on our latest productions and events, and check out atlantaopera.org for more information. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way for more people like you to find out about our content. And don't forget to follow the Atlanta Opera podcast for more great episodes.